Jim, what is your approach to negotiating?
That's a great question. You know, I've always taken the approach that I have to deliver, and I have to know what I deliver. And I've always found that by knowing what I'm delivering in depth and really having a complete vision of what's delivered and what it brings to the adversary, my respected opponent, what it benefits and how it benefits them, I've always found that to be a very important piece to the equation. And without that, I've seen failure. So my approach has always been to have a complete vision of what I deliver and be able to relay that to the adversary.
Is negotiating a skill that you are taught in a formal classroom setting, or is it a skill set that comes with experience?
Well, I believe I remember my first agreement with my mom when I was about 4 years old that I wouldn't take extra cookies out of the cookie jar. I think that's what I remember about my first negotiation. We're all negotiators. The definition of negotiation, according to the Oxford Dictionary, and I've never found a better one, by the way, is negotiation is the human effort to bring about agreements between two or more parties, with all parties having the right to veto. So we're all out there making agreements since our childhood, as far back as we can remember. So it's all about habit. Unfortunately, our habits change as we get older. And because negotiations are 100% emotional until a decision is reached, every decision we make in our brain is made in a complete 100% emotional arena. And as we get older and fear of failure starts to set in, you know, the younger we are, the more fearless we are. So it's not till older years that fear starts to set in. And when it does, we change our habits. So if we don't work hard in the classroom to hone our skills of what we brought forward as a child, we're making a terrible mistake. And worse, giving an example, win-win. It's a compromise-based, feel-good, assumption-generating process that costs millions of dollars every day to people. So it's a wrong-minded classroom setting. We've got to get to the classroom setting where creating vision and driving decision are the mainstays of negotiation. And you get that in the classroom, Michael. You're not going to get that just winging it.
How is what you teach when it comes to negotiating different from what we've all seen, the win-win model?
You'll find that when my clients prepare and I'm coaching, we never discuss compromising, cutting our price, changing our terms, having fallback positions. That's all gobbledygook. It's very, very weak. In fact, it drives more of that in us, because if we're indicating to the other side that's the way we do business, they're going to ask for more and more and more. And because the experts from the great universities say that's what you got to do because that's the way you do it, wow, we're stuck. So what we do, our system's built around decision-making. Some of my clients call it decision science negotiation or decision-based negotiation. But we work hard at creating and developing the behavioral habits and the tools of behavior that create vision for the other party and allow the other party, they have the right to veto. So we take as much pressure off of the decision as possible and allow them to envision what we're delivering. And when we're asked to compromise, we ask, how can we deliver this vision if we cut our price? So it's a whole different methodology.
What's the biggest misconception with your methodology of negotiating?
Well, unfortunately, my publishers, when I first wrote the book Start With No, they demanded that title, and I acquiesced because it was a take-it-or-leave-it deal. They literally told me, Jim, if you want this published, that's the title. And so I went with it because no is a very important piece of the book. But, you know, the perception is that I'm a walk-away guy. I've had people say, well, you teach people to walk away. That's absolutely not true. In fact, it's the exact opposite. We never walk away. So we're told to go away, but we don't make the decision to walk away because out of fear or out of failure. So it's a complete misconception.
What's the ultimate goal with your negotiating system?
The ultimate for me is that I would like my students, my clients, to be dropped into a terrible environment and be able to instantly begin negotiating and build themselves a sound foundation and build them success into the future in the worst of times. That's kind of my mission and purpose for my clients, so that they truly become secure in life.
What's the single most important thing one needs to know about negotiating? Is it to start out with strong demands so that you have some room to fall back?
Well, see, that question comes from the typical win-win collective bargain mindset. You know, they're starting out, do I ask for a lot and compromise back? Do I ask for what I want and hope that they're gracious enough to give it to me? That's a mindset of fear. How do I negotiate? They have no concept of real negotiation. They're dealing with a false legislated Railway Labor Act product called collective bargaining, give and take, which morphed into win-win. So it's all compromise-based and assumption-based. So that's a very good example of a question asked by someone that's kind of lost in the world of negotiation.
How do you factor in the cultural differences? You know, that previous question makes me think, let's say you're in Egypt and you're in the fruit market, and I assume these guys really know how to negotiate and there's no prices at their fruit stand, and you say, how much for these bananas? Let's say you're a tourist and he's going to give you a real high price and you're going to say, no, that's too much, and then he'll lower the price, you'll buy the bananas, and he got what he wanted originally. Isn't that kind of the win-win negotiating style?
No, that's just bargaining. I mean, I've got a dollar, you've got an orange. How much of my dollar are you going to take? And I want that orange, but do I want it badly enough to pay the number you've given? That's just back and forth bargaining. Of course, that's negotiation. It just so happens, Michael, that's a great question. I wonder how many people who ask that question have ever been to the Gold Saudi Arabia in Riyadh, or, as they say, the meat stand in Cairo, Egypt, or where they have a leg of lamb hanging in 100-degree temperature. I'll tell you my favorite story about this. A long time ago, I was in Saigon in 1967 in early December, just about this time of that year in 67, the 1st of December. And I was looking for presents for my grandparents, and they were very special to me. And I was buying some things for others, and my parents were important too, but I really wanted to do something for my grandparents. And I went by a stand where they made beautiful ornate boats, junks, if you will, miniature junks like models out of water buffalo horn that had been carved, and they were really pretty and ornate. And I remember looking at them, and I asked Mama-san how much for the two boats, and she said 1,500 piastres. Now, 1,500 piastres at that time was about $7, and I couldn't pay $7 for one present, even though I wanted to do it for my grandparents, because I only had about $20 total for the whole family. So I said, no, thank you. I'm sorry. I can't do it. She said, for you, special price, $1,400. I said, geez, I'm sorry. I was thinking more like $3. And I didn't want to embarrass her by any means. I didn't want to be the ugly American, so I just apologized. I couldn't do it. I went on my way. And I finished my shopping, and I had $4 or $5 left as I was coming back by the store headed for the base. And behind me came the lady that I'd seen earlier in the day. G.I., you stop it. You stop. So I stopped. She said, you come back. And she drug me by the arm back to the store. And she said, how much do you pay? And I said, I don't want to embarrass you. I only have TT money. She said, you tell me how much you pay. I said, I can pay 700 piastres, which is $3.50. And she looked at me and said, oh, gee, you know. I said, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to embarrass you. And I turned to leave. She said, no, G.I., you take.
Okay, so what's the lesson in this story?
The lesson in the story is that I said no, I couldn't afford that. And she never once asked me who they were for. She never once asked me how important my grandparents were to me. And what would it be like in the United States on Christmas when they found these beautiful boats that were this artwork from Vietnam, these hand-carved boats? And what would be the lasting memories my grandparents would have? She never created any vision for me. She was so desperate to make the deal, all she could think about was compromise. And there was no compromise in my negotiation. There was just creating the vision for her, but I couldn't afford it. It didn't fit my budget. Now, I know that sounds really simple, but that's in 1967 in a third world war-torn country. To me, it's negotiation. It's the mindset. Had I been her, I'd asked who they were for. And then I'd have created a vision of how the gift would be opened and who would be there and what would be the impact. But she never did that.
Yeah, she was just focused on herself. I think a lot of people may confuse negotiating with bargaining. How is it different from bargaining? And then what you're talking about sounds like selling to me as well.
You're exactly right. Here's the key. Have you ever watched President Obama sell his position on TV?
Oh, yeah.
He's also negotiating with the world, right?
Yep.
In fact, he's negotiating with people that don't even know they're negotiating with him. And it's kind of interesting. Now, I understand bargaining. I'm very, very good at it. In collective bargaining, I've actually coached union negotiations on both sides, management, government, and union.
Describe for the listeners, what is collective bargaining?
Collective bargaining is when there's two parties across the table from each other, and they bargain with compromise and give and take, and they give up something to get something. And a lot of times it involves, for example, hiding the ball. Now, I know that person in Egypt at the fruit stand, the ugly American, will probably overpay because they don't see it as a game. They see it as being offensive. Yet the Egyptian trader, it's life to him. It's a way of life. It's like our playing football on Saturday afternoon in college towns. And so it's a way of life for him. And for that visiting American, they can afford a quarter, so give it up. And they do very easily. But bargaining is the process of giving something to get something. And what's amazing to me, Michael, is you produce a product, you spend X number of dollars in production, X number of dollars in editing, X number of dollars in advertising and marketing, X number of dollars for the person who's going to travel the world selling the product, and they ask for a discount. And it's interesting, the mindset is, well, I have to give them a discount because it's win-win. Yet you've had all this expense, and then they call it a commodity. And your artwork is never going to be a commodity. Yet you hear that term all the time, because if it's a commodity, that makes it corn or wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade. And it goes down to bargaining of what the market will bear. And if Anheuser-Busch needs enough wheat or corn or barley or whatever they buy, and there's very little of it available, the price is going to go up.
So bargaining is win-win.
Win-win is bargaining.
Okay, what do you mean by hiding the ball?
It's kind of interesting. In bargaining, you don't want the other side to know what you'll take or what you'll accept. Just like Mama San in Vietnam, there was no way she was going to tell me early on 700 piastres. That was what she was willing to take. She was hiding the ball. And in union negotiations, maybe they're happy with their health care plan, their dental plan, and maybe they don't even care about a vision plan. What they really want is a pay raise, and so they'll drive a vision plan, an extended vacation plan, which they don't care about. They'll put out four or five things that they don't want. They'll hide the ball of that pay raise somewhere in there. And the pay raise will be a part of it, but they'll pretend all these other things are more important or as important. So they'll fight hard and try to hide the ball.
Just like she wanted a higher price than you were willing to pay.
That's right. But I didn't hide the ball. I told her I couldn't pay it. And I couldn't. It wasn't a ruse on my part. I just didn't have the money.
So how do you factor in cultural differences when it comes to negotiations?
Well, just like Mama-san, there is no cultural differences in negotiation. But let me tell you what there is, Michael. The secret to negotiating with anyone in the world, here, there, anywhere, is respect. The demonstration of respect. You think about this now. You hear the term power, leverage, partnership, all these disingenuous words. And what happens, that demonstration of disrespect builds barriers. The attitude of our negotiators, our diplomats, when sitting in third world countries, comes off as haughty. Comes off as disrespectful. I've seen that dozens of times in my work as a coach. People will say little things like, well, you know, those people are this or those people are that. I say, whoa, wait a minute, stop. You can't load your mind with such disrespect. What do you mean those people? If you think they're not as smart as you, or you think back on the little people in Vietnam, and look how long we were there in that quagmire, and look at the mess we made of it. So that lack of respect, that mindset, and that demonstration of disrespect, that's the whole problem with negotiating worldwide. So it's not culture. It's not studying culture. Every brain on the planet makes decisions exactly the same way. They make it with vision in the emotional arena. And so we have no problem doing deals in every culture on the planet.
What skill, Jim, do you think is most critical to a successful negotiation?
The skill to create vision for the adversary or adversaries you're engaged with and even not engaged with. What I mean by that is you'll be shocked at how many people will write a letter and never think of creating vision. They'll just make demands, and that letter will be circulated amongst the stakeholders in the negotiation they don't even know exist. So every engagement, every communication that's trying to bring about agreement has to create vision. And it has to create vision so that they discover the benefits to them.
If you boil it down to the absolute most fundamental basics, and it may be vision, what are the stages you go through in a tough negotiation?
Number one is you have to have a valid mission and purpose in place. You have to absolutely have a clear vision of your long-term aim, your continuing task and responsibility. That's step one. And that step never leaves you. In every engagement, at every juncture, you have to have that solidly in place. You have to own it. It has to be so clear to you that you see it clearly. And the reason you have to have that is because it will drive the decisions you make during the next stages of the negotiation. The second stage is as problems arise or as problems exist in the beginning, they must be dealt with. They must be negotiated. You can't allow an elephant to stay in the room with you while you work through hard negotiations. You've got to solve problems day in and day out as they arise. The third step is you have got to clear your mind of any opinions, assumptions, expectations. All of that's got to go away. That's the thing we teach called blank slate. We've got to blank our mind throughout the negotiation process. Number four is we have got to pay close attention when the adversaries demonstrate their emotions, their baggage, their expectations. We've got to pay close attention to that and note that. We have to have that written down, and we have to use that to deal with that, to create vision that solves that. And then next to last, and this is the hardest part, Michael. I know it sounds easy, it sounds simple, but this is probably the hardest thing. We have to know exactly what we want. And the more difficult the negotiation, the more we have to take it in bite-sized chunks. It never ceases to amaze me. We're getting ready to go into a $500 million negotiation, and I'll ask one of the team members, what do we want? Well, we want the deal. And we haven't even engaged with the other party yet. Do we really want the deal, or do we want to take the first step in pursuing our mission and purpose and uncovering what the first real problems are we have to deal with? What do we really want here? So what we want is a terribly key ingredient. And then lastly, we have to know step by step what's going to happen next. And we have to pay close attention so that we negotiate what's going to happen next so that we stay on track through the most difficult of negotiations. Now, if we do that, I've had negotiations that have lasted 2 years and have been for hundreds of millions of dollars, actually more than a billion in a couple cases. And they've taken a couple years, but that's what we have to do.
Why should the listeners want to learn more about the subject of negotiating? What's in it for them?
Everything. The entire world moves on agreements. The better the agreement, the longer lasting the agreement, the stronger the agreement. It's everything. Everything we do in life is an agreement. Getting a child to go to school is a critical agreement in a family. If the listening audience really thinks about their life, it's their agreements that deliver everything they wish for in life. No person is an island by themselves.
Do you have a mind map about all the steps or which specific steps to follow when conducting a negotiation?
That's what we call system. In another life, I was a jet pilot, and you cannot operate a highly sophisticated piece of equipment without a system, and negotiations are no different.
What do you think is the most important attitude to carry into any negotiation?
I think you go into a negotiation with an attitude of calmness simply because you are calm and simply because you do have the confidence, because you know exactly what you're delivering, and you've mastered the tools to deliver it. So ultimately, even the most difficult negotiation, even life and death, and I have been involved in some of those with the FBI, that calmness, that attitude of calmness and confidence, you know, you're fully prepared and you know exactly where to go at every step and turn. I think that's the attitude we should all be striving for. This is not something you get on Monday and you have for the rest of your life. This is something you're constantly working at. Negotiations, making agreements, and building agreements is a human performance event. Just like playing quarterback on a football team, playing a violin, riding a bicycle, flying an airplane, being a great speaker, all those things that you master in a human performance events continually take work and observation of performance and correction of weaknesses and try to turn them into strengths. It's the old adage, you know, you've got to take your weakest point and try to make it better and make your very best point even better than that. So, you know, it's an ongoing process. It never ends. And that's why I preach to my clients, pay attention. When you're reading a book, pull out of the book some negotiation, and it's an aha moment for you. But you've got to become a student of the game.
You mentioned FBI, and it just sounds like a great story. Is it something you can share?
Oh, sure. They came public about 18 months ago. I was shocked. Someone Googled my name and read that there was a blurb from the FBI about me, and because I had signed some pretty heavy-duty confidentiality agreements. And what had happened in the Philippines back when my first book first came out, they had a hostage crisis negotiation go bad in the Philippines, and they lost two people. And the agent was coming back from Manila, landed at Dulles Airport there in Washington, and was walking by the bookstore and had heard about my book, never saw it on the shelf, and there it was on the shelf. So he grabbed it and started looking at it and became intrigued. Next thing you know, they called me and asked me if I'd come to Quantico, Virginia. I ended up helping them build their whole training package for hostage crisis negotiators who deal with terrorists and hostage takers. They're the official branch of the government that does that. And it was thrilling. I had no idea that what I was teaching in my commercial arena to my clients, I had no idea what I was teaching and coaching could apply to that arena. And when I got to Quantico and got inside the closed doors in the safe room where we could talk, and they said, Jim, what we do, we can't compromise. And there's not one page in your book about compromise. I mean, we can't give up cars and boats and airplanes, and we can't let these people escape. So we just can't compromise. We have to help them see. They've got to discover that they're going to survive. So what came out of that was my teaching on mission and purpose, and the FBI actually went on the Internet and said that I created a revolution in negotiation, the biggest revolution in the last 50 years.
That's exciting. So are they actually using the revamped negotiating?
Oh, yes. For example, they're teaching right now agents all over the world. When the bad guy calls and said, if you don't give me $500 million in the next hour, I'm going to cut this person's head off. And the very first thing out of the agent's mouth is, my name is Agent Smith, and it's my purpose to help everyone in this situation remain safe and come out alive. How can you help me do that? So that's a statement of mission and purpose right into an interrogative-led question, which is exactly what we teach. That's a minor point of what came out of the training.
That's a wonderful story. Thanks for sharing that. What is the one thing you believe that all great, truly great negotiators have?
I think all the great ones have a very clear vision of what they're communicating, and they have the ability to help others see it. I've studied as many of the great men in the world as I could, and I've got a couple that come to mind. When you think of Winston Churchill, and you think of the great radio broadcast of the BBC, and the most troubled time of our world up to now, and the apocalypse of World War II, and when he said, "We will fight them on the beaches. We will fight them in the fields. We will fight them in the towns. We will fight them in the streets. And even if we are subjugate, even if we are overrun, we have every confidence that our children from the West will come and rescue the old." And he was painting a vision of the German troops landing on the beaches. We're going to fight them there. The whole world saw his stonewall of defense attitude, and he had confidence in Canada, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, India, the other children of the world would come to save the old. And he created that vision. That's one example. So he was a master of it. And actually, he was one of the great leaders, probably of modern times. The second I think of is President Lincoln, who, of course, gave the Gettysburg Address, which literally changed the political spectrum of the United States forever. In so few brief words, he created such a vision. It's really amazing. The other thing that I'd point out, the Gettysburg Address, of course, is a giant creation of vision, but there was a smaller one. And Horace Greeley, at that time was a publisher of a famous New York newspaper, had asked Lincoln his purpose, kind of an antagonist. And the president wrote back to Greeley and publicized a letter, "You asked me my purpose. My purpose is to reunite the Union. My purpose is to bring the Union together and unite the country. If you ask me would I free the slaves, I would if it would unite the country. You ask me if I would not free the slaves, I would not free them if it would unite the country." So he created the vision of laser-like focus of what his whole being was about. And I know that there's a lot of writings that a lot of the troops and the families gained strength for him creating the vision of the purpose of what they were doing in the Civil War. And that vision carried them through. So I really believe, and if the listener will pay close attention to the really greats, they'll find them creating vision with words that allow people to make decisions to get behind them.
How do you decide whether to negotiate something or not? What guidelines do negotiators use to determine whether or not to negotiate or not negotiate something?
It's really pretty simple for myself and my clients. It either fits our mission and purpose or it doesn't. We don't negotiate if it doesn't fit our mission and purpose. We just don't get involved because it doesn't fit. I get approached every day with advertising, just numerous things that don't fit my mission and purpose, my long-term aim, so I don't engage. It's pretty straightforward and simple for me. Now, is it perfect? No. Sometimes I question, it might fit my mission and purpose, and I'd rather make a mistake and discover it a little later, so I'll negotiate. But if it turns out it doesn't fit, then I'll let it go.
How do you make sure you're dealing with the real decision maker in a negotiation?
That's a really great question because that's the key. Because if you really think about decision making, it runs the spectrum. So what we do is we're constantly engaged, literally, across the spectrum, meaning we'll ask who else would help with this, who else should we engage, who else should we talk to, and even if they're not mentioned, we'll try to envision how the decision might be made, and we'll attempt to engage people if they say, look, that's just not my department. For example, the president of one company asked one of his directors to call me today, and we talked, and I asked a few questions, and he said, I'm really glad I got to talk with you, but that's not my department. But I'll tell you, I'm going to call the person who is in that department because I know the president wants someone from us to talk with you, someone from our organization, so let me introduce you to them. And that's fine. Oftentimes, they'll tell you who you should be talking with. But even then, to assume he or she is the decision maker is really a mistake. So it's a constant effort to uncover the decision making. And always keep in mind that it's never perfect science in the decision making. Because you never know, a wife, an assistant, who knows, someone may have influence in the decision we'd never thought of. So we're constantly trying to uncover it.
There must be a lot of time in the world where people are negotiating to the wrong people.
Oh, it happens all the time, Michael. And I'll tell you, it's the greatest waste of resources on the planet. It really is. I've seen people say, well, gee, this thing hasn't moved for 6 months, and I wonder why. The person they're talking to is not qualified. Another thing that interests me about this is it's shocking how many people that will listen to this interview will spill their beans and everything to someone who could never make the decision. And they'll turn the negotiation over to them to negotiate for them against them. For example, a purchasing agent. There's not a purchasing agent on the planet that can approve a purchase. They can recommend it. They can try to drive the terms up and the prices down. All of those things, but they cannot make the decision. So what do? We cut our prices 3 or 4 times to the purchasing agent, never dealing with the people responsible.
Todd says, I believe that negotiating is learning the beliefs and wants and desires of the other person. Do you believe that psychology plays a big role in negotiating?
How many of us really have a vision and are looking at our real problem? How many of us really want to look at our real problem and are able to face up to it ourselves? Not very many. So what happens is the psychology of helping someone see the real problems, the real challenges they have that they don't want to face is truly a master negotiator, and that's all psychology.
Is there a basic psychology to winning, or is there a basic rule to win when negotiating, like never giving in first or always give in first, etc.?
That all comes out of very weak ivory tower theories and thoughts about winning and losing. You can't win or lose a negotiation, Michael. You can only move your mission and purpose forward or maintain the status quo. So in a negotiation, your job is to move your mission and purpose forward. It's not about winning or losing. And if you can't move it forward, then remain where you are. Don't give up ground. So this whole idea of, you know, I've got to win, it becomes almost debilitating emotionally because, see, all of our decisions are emotionally driven. Every decision we make is made 100% emotionally. And anything we do to raise the fire of emotion, for example, expectation of winning, expectation of losing, the fire goes up, decision-making starts to falter and starts to fall away. And you can see it in people in panic mode. They'll absolutely make the wrong decision almost every time because they're absolutely panicked. They have no place to go to in their system. They have no anchoring spot. So this whole thing about winning and losing, as soon as someone says, well, look, we've got to have a win-win agreement here. You know, they've got the expectation that they know what's a win for me. I don't even think in terms of win. They don't even know that. And they're worried about winning. So anything they offer me is not going to fit. So why don't we just cut to the chase and give me your best number? And when they do, that's not going to work. Yeah, I need your help here. We really want a win-win agreement here for the sake of the relationship. I just turn the tables against them. It's sad.
How important is persuasion architecture in negotiations?
I learned a long time ago I can't persuade anybody to do anything. I mean, we all know that seatbelts save lives. But by golly, some youngster dies in my neighborhood every couple of years because they weren't wearing a seatbelt in a simple auto accident that should have not been a problem. So I don't even try to convince or persuade. It's not even in my vocabulary or my coaching. What is in my vocabulary is helping discovery and giving people permission to reject what they're seeing. It's okay if you don't want to do this. It's okay if you don't want to fasten your seatbelt. Just tell me no, you don't want to fasten it. I mean, it's okay. I just can't start the car till you do. So we can't travel. So we can't go to the event. It's okay. You know, we don't have to go.
Jim, I'm new at negotiating. Do you currently or did you have, when you first started, a cheat sheet to keep on your mind while going into a negotiation? For example, to help you remember the top five things to focus on when going into negotiations, or do you have an acronym that you use to remind yourself of what to keep in mind when first trying to master negotiation? Also, when you first started negotiating, did you have any fears going into negotiation? And if so, how did you overcome them, and what did you focus on?
That's interesting. We'll take the first question first. I absolutely have, it's not a cheat sheet. This isn't a test. In a classroom in high school, we have what we call a checklist, step-by-step preparation, all written down, all scripted out, and we carry it into the negotiation with us, and we use it right in front of the adversary. No qualms about it. The key is how that checklist is put together and the rules and principles that make it so powerful. And it truly is our secret weapon. And we have a debriefing document we call a log. It makes up the camp negotiation management system. The second question, was I ever fearful in the beginning and in the beginning of starting negotiations? No, I was never fearful. And I've been in some very large negotiations at a very young age. I've been surprised, but I was never fearful because I never expected anything to come of it anyway. I mean, I never really needed to make a deal. I never needed, notice that word need. It was never survival for me, so I was excited. I loved the game. Couldn't wait for the whistle to blow and to get started. It wasn't fear. I always felt prepared, and I always felt that it was up to them to make a decision. It was up to me to help them see it, and whatever they decided was up to them. So